This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear from the daughter of a casualty of the Holy Land Foundation case. Nora Lashi will talk about the case and the conditions under which her father is being held.
65 years for heading a charity that gave humanitarian aid to Palestinians.
We'll talk with Professor Rick Wolf about austerity. Why and for whom?
Have you noticed your subway running less often? Your post office closing? That's austerity on the backs of the working people.
Stay with us.
Today we talk with Nur Alashi. Nur is the daughter of Holy Land Foundation prisoner Ghassan Alashi. Ghassan is currently held on a 65-year sentence in the Communications Management Unit. He is serving 65 years. That's right. You heard it. 65 years because he was head of the Holy Land Foundation, which the United States charged was giving aid, humanitarian aid, to a, quote, front for Hamas. Hamas is on the U.S. terrorist list. The committees he was giving to in Palestine, Zakat committees, had been given aid by USAID and other such organizations. But of course, the U.S. only went after the Holy Land Foundation. And there was little, in fact, probably no evidence that the leadership of the Holy Land Foundation had any idea or any knowledge that Zakat was a front, which it may not be, probably is not, of Hamas. And yet, 65-year sentence. So today with us is Ghassan's daughter, Nur, who will tell us both about what happened at the trials, what happened at the conviction, and the terrible conditions under which her father is being held. Nur, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
And we're going to start, actually, by listening to a brief excerpt from the book that you're working on.
Yeah, I'm working on a book. I'm actually a student at the New School right now. I'm halfway through the program. And the working title is actually Eyes Like My Father, A Daughter's Narrative of Displacement. And I'm just going to read a little excerpt today that I feel like really illustrates who my father is and just his sensitivity toward human plight. So here I go. One day, a year after Baba's imprisonment, I saw him in our garden dressed casually with a camera around his neck. I asked him where he was going, and he said he was planning to march around downtown Dallas to protest the immigration bill that was being debated in Congress. He asked if I wanted to join him, but I told him I had work. Later that night, he told me that I missed a great moment in American history. See for yourself, he said, proudly flipping through the pictures on his digital camera. We shared a passion for photography, but his lighting was impeccable and his subjects were hardly ever posed. These pictures captured the vibrant ambiance of a united cause. There was nothing like it, he said, referring to the river of 500,000 people wearing white who poured onto the otherwise non-pedestrian downtown streets. He, too, wore white and waved the Mexican flag. He, too, chanted Si se puede.
Now, this is an excerpt about your father.
Yes.
And this is in Dallas. And, of course, he was not in prison at the time, obviously, right? Because
right.
He was in this march. And how much longer after that march did he go to prison?
About a year.
About a year afterwards.
About a year after.
And he's in for what sentence now?
He was sentenced to 65 years in prison for giving material support in the form of humanitarian aid to Zakat committees, or which are Palestinian charities in the West Bank and Gaza that prosecutors were alleging were fronts for Hamas. Now, these were the exact same Zakat committees that USAID, you know, the Red Cross, the UN, European, you know, just all sorts of CARE, C-A-R-E, just all international NGOs were giving money to these same exact Zakat committees. And that was because this was the way to distribute money to the Palestinian needy.
Now, he gave it through a foundation that was the biggest Muslim charity in the United States called the Holy Land Foundation, which he was executive director or founder or something. Is that right?
He was the co-founder and he was the chairman of this charity. And yes, it became the largest Muslim charity in the U.S. until the Bush administration, with an executive order, shut it down 3 months after 9/11.
If I recall, the argument is, of course, you can't, under our law, give money directly to Hamas because it's on a U.S. terrorist list, and it's considered materially aiding terrorism to give anything to Hamas, even if it's blankets for young kids or anything. I mean, just completely prohibited. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the claim was that this foundation was not giving directly to Hamas, that the U.S. didn't say that, but was giving to these Zakat committees, which, as you've pointed out, were taking money from all kinds of institutions, including U.S. institutions, mm-hmm. and yet they went after the Holy Land Foundation and five of its key members, including your dad, by claiming that the Zakats were a front, essentially, for Hamas, and your father knew that in doing this. Do I have it about roughly right?
Yeah, you have it exactly right. They definitely tried to make it a very convoluted argument, but this is why this material support law is a very flawed law. It's very broad, it's very vague, and it's basically singling out, you know, Muslim charities. And at this point, with the recent Supreme Court decision regarding the material support law and how they upheld the law, I feel like every American is at risk at this point in time, and this is definitely the time to sort of wake up, because what it essentially says is that anybody who gives humanitarian aid is at risk.
Now, tell us a bit about the trial. Was this issue of hypocrisy raised, that actually U.S. organizations were also giving money but weren't being prosecuted?
Yeah. This was definitely mentioned in the trial. There was actually two trials, and the first trial was in 2007. It was a three-month trial, and these arguments were made, you know, that a lot of these international and national NGOs were giving money to the same exact Zakat committees that were listed on the HLF indictment. Now, this
HLF is Holy Land Foundation.
The Holy Land Foundation indictment. So these were the exact same Zakat committees that were listed on the HLF indictment. Now, the first trial lasted 3 months after 19 days of deliberation, which was pretty much, you know, a record. There were many records and many bizarre instances in this trial. But after a three-month trial, 19 days of deliberation, you know, after sifting through hundreds of thousands of documents and 12-plus years of investigation, the jury actually returned zero guilty verdicts. They actually deadlocked on most counts against the Holy Land Five. But because of that fact, the judge declared a mistrial, which actually gave the prosecutors the right to retry the case.
And one thing that's interesting about the first trial, I saw in the excellent little booklet that people can get.
The name of the booklet is Defending Charity, Supporting the Holy Land Five.
And the website for that is
freedomtogive.com. And I'm actually, that's under construction. It's still up, but it's being revamped at this point.
In that booklet, there's some jurors that speak after the trial.
Right.
That basically say, the government was throwing everything at us except anything that would prove the defendants guilty, essentially. They said they showed a picture of a bus blown up. By whom? Maybe Hamas, maybe somebody else. But they just showed all these, you know, these terrible scenes. And they expected the jury, just from being essentially prejudiced by seeing these terrible scenes, to convict your father. The jury didn't.
That was exactly right. And that lead juror that you're talking about, his name was William Neal. And that's essentially what he said. And that was the majority opinion, really, was that they kept showing us things around the charges, but they never actually showed us any evidence. There was no evidence that linked these men to Hamas. These were humanitarians and nothing else. Unfortunately, the second time around, in 2008, about a year later, it was essentially, when people ask what's the difference between the first and the second trial, and it was essentially the same arguments. Sure, the prosecutors were a bit more aggressive in nature. They did interview a few jurors after the first trial. And sure, each side brought in maybe a couple extra witnesses, but essentially the arguments were the same, which is why we were all shocked. and not just the defense attorneys, but the families and just civil libertarians all over the world were just flabbergasted when the jury returned all guilty verdicts after, about 9 days of deliberations.
And where did the trials take place?
They took place in downtown Dallas, which is a tough crowd, that's for sure.
And your father then immediately was incarcerated with a sentence of 65 years?
It took several months for the sentencing was in May of 2009. My father was sentenced to 65 years in prison. And the other members...
Your father's name, I want to get the pronunciation right.
My father's name, Ghassan.
Ghassan.
It's Ghassan Elashi, yeah. And he, along with the CEO, Shukri Abu Baker, received a 65-year sentence. The other men, there was a fundraiser, a volunteer fundraiser. There was a New Jersey representative. There was a California HLF office representative. And those were all sentenced to between 15 and 20 years. The CEO and the co-founder, my father, were both received pretty much lifelong sentences.
I mean, apart from the spuriousness of the whole trial and the charges, mm-hmm. the idea is that even if they were convicted, 65 years just seems,
he's 55 years old.
But it's a mouth-dropping sentence. I mean, for any crime, that's usually that a judge might give that if there was a mass slaughter of somebody mm-hmm. directly shooting down 20 people against a wall or something. Mm-hmm. But, it's the craziest thing. I'm just floored by it.
Your father is incarcerated in what is called a...
Communications Management Unit. It's definitely a euphemism. and these CMUs, which are essentially little Guantanamos. That's what they've been called because two-thirds of the population are of Middle Eastern descent. And there are two of them. There's one in Marion, Illinois, and one in Terre Haute, Indiana. And these opened very recently, actually. One was opened in 2006. One was opened in 2008. And the purpose of these prisons, which are... Actually, these units within larger prisons are to closely monitor inmates, restrict them from communicating with the outside world, which really includes media, their attorneys, their families.
Limited phone calls. They're
phone
very
calls,
restrictive.
I get one phone call a week from my father. It's 15 minutes, As far as visitations go, those in and of themselves are cruel and unusual punishment because you only get two visitations a month, and once you do travel all that long way, you don't get to touch, I'm not going to get to touch my father, I'm not going to get to hug him because the visitation has to take place behind a plexiglass wall. Now, everything, phone calls, visitations, are all live monitored from Washington, D.C. and have to be scheduled in advance, so...
The Center for Constitutional Rights has a lawsuit against the CMU's Communication Management Unit.
Exactly.
Units, and we've also covered this on the show, but that your father was in it. When did he go in it, actually?
He was transferred there in April or May, so pretty recently. And the other members of the case, the other defendants, are actually... Four of them are being held at these communication management units, two in Marion, two in Terre Haute, and then one of them is being held just in California in a separate prison.
How is your father's mental state right now?
Well, my father is more optimistic than you can imagine. He sort of has to be, but he's always been optimistic. That's who he is. And he's very hopeful. He does yoga and Pilates. That's what pretty much really nourishes his body. And he reads a lot of Quran, and that's what really keeps his soul going. On sentencing day, I feel like he pretty much stood up in court and said a few words of true inspiration. And I also feel like this pretty much reflects his thoughts on this case and just this whole ordeal. But he says basically that nothing in my life was as satisfactory as knowing that I could sign a check. The evidence that is used against me, it's the only evidence you have used against me, signing the check. But that was the most enjoyable part of my life, knowing that I could sign a check to assist hundreds of Palestinian families who were displaced after their homes were demolished. Nothing was more satisfactory to me than granting scholarships to hundreds of Palestinian students who had average grades despite the circumstances. Nothing was as rewarding to me than being a catalyst and turning zakat into real-life assistance to orphans and needy families. He actually feels very proud of what he's done, and if he had the chance to do it again, he would. He says that opening the charity in the late 80s, he actually knew that there was going to be a risk, but he went ahead and did everything possible to pursue this, and he did everything to stay within the law. He approached FBI agents, he approached State Department and Justice Department and Office of Foreign Assets Control. This was all throughout the 90s after hearing reports, you know, from lobby pro-Israeli lobby groups and just pro-Israeli politicians and just these false reports linking the Holy Land Foundation to Hamas. He went ahead and basically sought guidance from all these governmental organizations saying, please, are we doing anything wrong? We're following the law. We're doing what everybody else is doing. But he was still singled out and he was still targeted.
Do you think your father had been targeted since he opened the foundation?
There are definitely well-documented instances of persecution throughout the 1990s, you know, these agenda-driven reports that took place. And this was by pro-Israeli lobby groups, by pro-Israeli politicians like Chuck Schumer and, you know, Elliot Spitzer and Nita Lowey, and just a variety of names. But it was Chuck Schumer who actually co-authored the anti-terrorism law of 1996, which actually strengthened the material support provision.
People should know that's a Clinton-era law.
It was a terrible law.
Noor said, it added to the material aid provisions and did a lot of other very nasty things. And that really led to the post 9/11 laws. I mean, really.
Serious piece
of legislation and a bad one.
Yeah.
And do you have other family, and how are they dealing with this?
I'm actually the eldest of six children. We're three boys and three girls. The girls are all college students, the boys are all teenagers. And then my grandmother, my cousins, everybody's in Texas. And as far as my family, we actually haven't been able to visit my father.
Wanted you to talk about some of the problems we've had at the CMU, the Communications Management Unit.
Because essentially what's happened is you know, my family and my father, we've been punished twice. It's this double tragedy, and that is, you know, these convictions that were made possible by fear in the courtroom and the 65-year sentence. And then there's punitive punishment and just psychological torture as my father continues to move through the prison system. Now, when my father was still in Segalville, Texas, several months ago, it was in September, October of 2009, after one of the visitations, a prison guard who very obviously abused his power told my family, actually all the visitors and all the inmates, to disperse. And at that point, my younger brother Omar, who has Down syndrome, actually went and hugged my father. And the prison guard actually admonished my father at that point and said, "What, Mr. Alashi, you think you're an exception?" He ended up filing a complaint against my father, saying that he disobeyed him. There's an internal investigation that took place within the prison. Basically, the punishment was 6 months no visitation. And a month after that, they made an exception and they said, "You know what, we'll let you during the Eid holiday," you know, the Muslim holiday, they said, "We'll let you come and visit just one time." So my family went and visited my father. And what happened is that they usually, you know, there's only a maximum of five people who can visit at one time. And so my two brothers, again, teenagers, were in the prison parking lot and we're going to actually come in, and then my sisters were going to go out. They were going to trade places so my father can see the whole family. And we've been doing this for, you know, ever since we started visitation. So he was going to do that, but that same prison guard said that that's not allowed, that this is not a right, that this is just a privilege, and that you need to just deal with, you know, the situation that you're in. Your sons are going to have to stay out in the prison parking lot. So my father was very agitated. He got up. He made a comment comparing this prison guard to the, you know, Abu Ghraib, and said that you are just, you know, you're evil, and and he look, he turned to the visitors and he says, he won't even let me see my sons. Actually, at this point, my mother said, I'm going to have to go home because we can't leave my sons in the prison parking lot. There was another complaint filed against my father saying that he disrupted
this was at the
visitation. CMU? No, this was back in Texas. It was another 6 months no visitation. So essentially, the punishment was a one-year visitation ban. Now, when he was moved to the CMU, there was a little thread of hope, and that was we talked to experts, attorneys. Everybody said that once he moves to the CMU, that the visitation ban will not carry with him, that it will actually stay, that once he leaves the jurisdiction of the prison, you know, that it won't be moved. And so actually my mother, she made van reservations. I almost bought my plane ticket. You know, we spoke to the visitation officer at the CMU. He confirmed the visitation and everything. And then we were going to go see him. And then we get a call from the warden at the CMU saying that the visitation ban still applies. And despite what you heard from anybody else, you will not be able to see your father until September, October of 2010. So, of course, my family is just crushed because, you know, so this is what we've been having to deal with.
So no one's seen your father for quite a while.
I mean, we haven't seen him in several months.
Have you been getting his letters?
Yeah, I mean, we do. We get his letters. You know, there's also a prison email. It's a prison email system that everything is very much monitored, very closely read. It's definitely discouraging to communicate in that way. But I do. I mean, it's the only way I can communicate with him.
Now, there's an appeal pending in his case. He was convicted, sentenced to the 65 years, obviously not given bail, sent right to prison. But can you just tell us where in the appeal process is it?
Well, actually, just a few days after the material support law was upheld, the attorneys of the Holy Land Foundation case received the appeals or the notice for appeals briefing schedule. They have until August 3rd to file their initial briefs, and then the government has about a month to respond, and then the defense attorneys have about 2 weeks to file any other briefs. So it's definitely underway. Now, the material support law is very disheartening. And I spoke to my father's attorney not too long ago. The Supreme Court decision is very disheartening.
That's it's called the Humanitarian Law Project case.
Right.
And unfortunately, fortunately, it was a Center for Constitutional Rights case.
Right.
Argued by David Cole. And
right.
Who also I know is quoted in the booklet as saying, this case just shows the excesses of this law.
Exactly. You know, the defense attorneys are definitely disheartened by this decision, but they say that there are so many strong grounds for appeal that, you know, there's still a huge chance of us winning the appeal.
But that's good to hear from defense attorneys.
Yeah, I mean, strong grounds such as evidentiary issues as well as an anonymous witness. This was one of the bizarre things that happened during the first and second trial, is that the prosecutors brought in an anonymous Israeli intelligence officer who testified under a fake name. It's never happened in the history of a courtroom, but he basically got on the stand and said he could smell Hamas. Those were his exact words.
What he meant by that is that the aid groups that your father, that the Holy Land Foundation was giving money to, Zakat committees, mm-hmm. that Holy Land and other groups gave to, that when he said he could smell Hamas, he's saying, I sniff around Zakat committees and they smell like Hamas to me. That's what he's really saying.
That's essentially what mm-hmm. he was saying. But really, the defense attorneys were not able to properly cross-examine him because they didn't know who he was. They couldn't challenge, you know, him at all.
Could you see his face in court, or was he covered?
I could, but that in and of itself was very dramatic, because when they brought him in, they asked everybody. The courtroom was packed with people, like benches and benches of people. But when he came in, they asked everybody to evacuate the courtroom except the family members. So it went from about, you know, a dozen full benches to just about one or two benches. And everybody had to go up to an overflow room and actually listen to the testimony. But yeah, I mean, the family members were definitely able to see him.
We're speaking with Noor Elashi, whose father, Hassan Elashi, was convicted for essentially giving charity to Palestinians. and is starting a 65-year sentence, one of the most monstrous crimes in American history, according to George Galloway. Noor, I wanted to read you what your father's defense attorney, Nancy Hollander, said of this and ask for your reaction. Nancy said, "It's remarkable. My client was convicted of providing charity. There was not in 10 years of wiretapping his home, his office, looking at his faxes, listening to everything he said, there was not one word out of his mouth about violence to anyone or about support for Hamas. He provided charity. That's what he was convicted of." What kind of support have you been getting when you've been telling this horrible story about what's been done in our name? What kind of reaction you receiving from people? Because I noticed you were at the Detroit Social Forum. What's been your reaction to the kind of support that's out there?
Well, everybody I actually tell the story to are just absolutely outraged, really. And we've been getting overwhelming support. These are just from friends and just people who hear about the case. Of course, there are always, you know, community members who become fearful and just sort of shy away. But I will tell you that the Dallas community has been so supportive compared to other communities where similar situations have taken place. But we're actually in the midst of starting like a national campaign, like a defense committee, because it's definitely being argued, legally, and it's definitely being taken care of legally. But what I'm trying to do at this point with several other people is hopefully launch this like national campaign that will reach broad organizations and just reach media and make this a national and international issue. And this is very much the time to do so because of the material support decision and because of recent, you know, the flotilla attacks on international waters. These were humanitarians that were being attacked. And so this is very much the time, I feel like, and any support that we can receive regarding this campaign would be really wonderful.
And the website again?
freedomtogive.com.
To support the Holy Land Five against the efforts of this government to shut down Muslim charities.
I know you want to read something to us now and tell us what it is and what it's from.
So I wanted to actually end by reading another excerpt from my memoir in progress. And this is actually one sentence long, and it's about the first time that we visited my father in Segoville, Texas.
What's the name of the book again?
The book's name is Eyes Like My Father, A Daughter's Narrative of Displacement. By the time I finally saw him, I felt like I'd finished a marathon. I parked the van and reminded my mother and siblings that our visitation time will end in 2 hours, so we hurried down the long cement pathway, glanced at the towering barbed wire fence, entered through the glass double doors, and filled out several sign-in sheets stating that we did not possess drugs or weapons, and we took off our shoes and placed our clear plastic bags of dollars and coins on the counter, walking through the metal detector in 5-second intervals, and then we stuck out our hands for a guard to stamp with clear ink when suddenly a heavy gray door slid open, so we walked into the trap, prison lingo, for the small area designed for you to place your fists under an ultraviolet light, which we did, until the guard behind the glass window nodded and flipped the switch that opened the second door, and finally we were in the visitation room, which reeked of sweat and wet rags, and after handing the forms to the man sitting at the front, I saw several connected rows of seats, chairs that were not for us, since our only contact with Baba was going to take place behind a glass wall. So we waited for him in a bright-lit room, while my brothers wandered out to buy chips, chewy candy, and soda from the vending machine, food that's not good for them, high fructose corn syrup infested snacks. Meanwhile, Omar flipped through the pages of a ripped book and assembled a few pieces of a well-worn puzzle, and after 30 minutes of waiting, we heard someone shuffling behind the door at the other side of the glass enclosure, and at last, Baba entered the room, but his hands were still behind his back. His hands were still handcuffed, that is, until Baba squatted with his back against the door, his arms through a slot next to the knob, and allowed a guard to use a special key to detach his hands, causing Baba to rub the pink imprints around his wrists, sigh, and sit down.
Well, it's really moving. I just hear it. You know, it even reminds me of the visiting prisons, even apart from the fact whether it's your father or not, it's just an awful experience.
Yeah.
Just an awful experience. So thank you, Noor, and really, what can we say except we want our listeners to hear this show, go to the website, think about what our country has done to this man, to this family, to the Holy Land Foundation, and to all of us.
Thank you, Noor. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
We are very pleased to have with us Professor Rick Wolfe to update us on where we are in this ongoing global capitalist crisis. Austerity has appeared in the titles of many articles on the global economic crisis. What is it? Rick Wolfe writes in his article, titled Austerity, Why and For Whom, that the efforts to broaden the recovery beyond 1 year have failed, and that failure has cost Washington trillions in borrowed funds from lenders. Those lenders now demand guarantees that those loans will be repaid to them with interest. The guarantee demanded by lenders is, quote, austerity. To collect this austerity, the bank lenders want governments to raise taxes or cut government spending, or both. That's an extreme burden imposed on the global economy. Rick asks, why not collect austerity from nonprofit multinational corporations, churches, and private institutions that are already tax exempt? Rick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's been a few weeks since you've been on, and today we're going to talk about the subject of austerity. Can you explain what that is?
Yes, austerity is a term to describe what is basically a very simple thing. Over the last 3 years, as the crisis engulfed all of the world pretty much, country after country, government after government, was asked by their banks, their insurance companies, many of their larger corporations, to rescue them from imminent collapse. It started late in 2007, accelerated across 2008 and into early 2009. And everywhere, because of the nice relationship between finance and government, the governments complied with this request and spent literally trillions with a T to bail out all these institutions. Now, when a government has to spend suddenly so much more money, and we're not just talking about the United States government, which borrowed the most to do this, but all governments, they really have three ways to raise the money. They can print the money, but that's dangerous for inflation and for the value of the currency. They can tax their people, but that's politically dangerous and means a government that did that wouldn't be there very long. Or they have the third option, which is to borrow the money. And that's what all these governments suddenly did to enormous amounts of money. We've never seen that in the world economy before, such a surge of borrowing across the board.
When you say borrow, the way they borrow is they, how do they borrow it?
They issue what are called government bonds, treasury bonds in this country, and other government debt, it's called in general. And they hope somebody out there lends them the money, buys these pieces of paper, which in effect is lending them money for a specified length of time. The urgency of the impending crisis of capitalism, the second major collapse of capitalism in 75 years, was so intense, the terror in the ranks of business was so complete, that nobody stopped to worry, think about, just get the government, save us, give us lots of money, lend us lots of money, take toxic assets off our books by buying them from us, and so on. And nobody worried much about the government borrowing. So now we come full circle. Now, suddenly, with governments borrowing so much and being often governments that have already been borrowing for a long time, like the United States, suddenly the creditors, all the people who lend to the government, are beginning to get as nervous about their loans to governments as, for example, they were about subprime borrowers in the mortgage business not so long ago. And so the creditors have been going to the governments and saying, you know, we're not going to lend you much more money because you look like a government that's in such debt that your people may make you unable to pay it back. And we don't want to be stuck with the debt of a country that is in that situation. And so we're going to make a demand on you. We're not going to give you any new debt, and we're not even going to roll over, renew the debts that are outstanding that come due all the time, which would plunge these societies into collapse because they depend on credit and have become so over the last 25 years. So they really had these governments pretty much over a barrel.
When you say that, who is the we again?
The creditors, the people who lend. And I'll come to who they are a little bit later.
Good.
Anyway, they went to the governments and they said, okay, you're in deep doo-doo if you don't do the following. You either have to raise taxes on your people and put that money in a special account, which will only be used to pay us interest and pay back our principal. Or you cut your programs, your public services, and save that money and put it into the same special account to make sure. And if you don't do that, and if that money isn't there and visible to us in that account to pay us back, then it's end time for your debt. This terrifies any government, because if creditors actually stopped, didn't renew debt, then literally they would stop having to be able to pay their teachers, their school, their policemen, their social programs and everything else, or they would come in with a tax bill on their population. So whether it's raising taxes or cutting programs, the name for what we call the government response to the demand of its creditors is austerity. It's imposing on a society a severe regimen of rising taxes and or cut government spending to please and satisfy creditors.
But let me ask you, I understand this, please the creditors so they can basically pay their debt that the creditors have in their possession, the debts.
That's right.
But the creditors, are they in that strong position? Why can't the country just say, we'll go bankrupt?
They could.
But then they're finished, right?
Well, not that they're finished. Mm-hmm. Then they have declared war. That's the classic act of war between debtor and creditor. Mm-hmm. Sure, I'll give you an example. One of the governments that creditors have been really harsh with is the government of Greece. That's why Greece is in such trouble. That's why all public employees in Greece last month saw their wages cut between 15% and 20% with a promise of a further cut in October. That's why there are general strikes in Greece almost every other week now. There's a confrontation, and the pressure from the masses below includes a demand, for example, supported by the Communist Party of Greece, which is an important political party in that country, demanding default, demanding withdrawal from the European Union, and demanding
They're saying to the government, default on the bonds because we don't want to be put into a situation of having
of
our wages cut and
that's
austerity.
Right. And, okay. You know, the way they put it, which Americans might appreciate more, is to impose austerity on the mass of people. And let's be clear, that's what's being done in the United States, too. To impose on the mass of people an austerity, a combination of rising taxes and cut services, is basically to arrange to bail out capitalism's failure by hurting the mass of people. The cost of this crisis is in this way, through austerity, being shifted from the enterprises that brought it to us to the people who are going to be made to pay. And the austerity is just this indirect way of arranging that.
Critical point.
But isn't some form of austerity the responsibility of the borrower?
Good. The question is, when you do an austerity, when you make the decision, you know, which, as Michael said, is an open matter. You can default, just as individuals can go bankrupt or companies can go bankrupt and not pay their debts as one way out. But putting that aside for the minute, assume you're going to want to keep your creditors happy. Now the question is, when you raise taxes and you cut services, taxes on whom? Services for whom? Let me give you an example here drawn from the United States so Americans can understand it better. We have a policy in the United States that says if you are a private university and you have lots of wealth, no matter how much wealth you have, You do not pay any taxes on it. You do not pay to the federal government any income tax. You do not pay to the state government any processing tax, sales tax, anything else. And very important to the communities in which you live, you pay no property tax. I'll give you an example. Yale University, New Haven. A multi-billion dollar corporation with multi-billion dollars of annual income pays no taxes. If we're going to have an austerity in the United States, here's a question. At a time of national crisis, of an economic emergency, rather than increasing the taxes of the average person, why don't we do what we probably should have done long ago and really go through our tax structure and say, let's tax the people who've been having a holiday on taxes for a long time, but now, in this moment of crisis, is a reasonable time to go after them. Same issue in Greece.
I'd prefer if you would tax the churches and the temples.
Absolutely. The religious institutions, you know, and always you could have a break point. In other words, smaller institutions with a little bit of money are exempted the way we do that in many tax structures. So small universities that are basically paying as they go would not be hit. But we're talking about the Harvards and the Yales and the Princetons that are sitting on billions and billions of assets and so on. And yes, this would be the services. What services are going to be cut? For example, an austerity here in the United States could be handled by having money put aside for creditors by, say, ending the war in Iraq or in Afghanistan or reducing debt. There's a way. Cutting services that are not necessary in all kinds of ways. That's a political struggle, of course. So
no, instead, for our listeners here, instead what they plan to do is they're cutting certain subway lines altogether in New York.
Absolutely.
They're
already have.
Cutting post office possible.
Senior homes.
The delivery on Saturdays may not be existent anymore. I went to
libraries.
A post office the other day. No more pickups after 4 o'clock. I mean, it's already going in a real way.
Yeah. The reason in Europe, most services delivered to people and most taxes are done by the central government. They're relatively smaller countries. In our country, it's very confusing for people because we have three separate tax systems, federal, state, and local. So the federal government is not yet in a massive austerity program, but do look already what was done to the unemployment extension benefits over the last few weeks. There's already this notion we have to cut back, in our deficits, and that's all that austerity talk. But we already have austerity at the local and state levels, savage austerities. To anyone who's wondering, take a look at California. They're laying off thousands and thousands of state employees, cutting services left and right, and that's the norm across the United States, and it is increasingly the norm in city and town governments with their tax problems.
I mean, what I'm getting from you is really clearly, though, is what's happening is after capitalism goes into crisis and the money gets loaned to the capitalists, then they shift who's going to pay for
that
onto the backs of working people. That's one. And secondly, they're doing it through an austerity that is going again after those same people rather than austerity in the military budget or
multinational corporations.
Well, I can make it even more stark for you, this shifting of the process. There are two indices that will and should upset your listeners. First, every year there's something called a World Wealth Report. It is produced by Merrill Lynch Corporation together with a research outfit called Capgemini. Very famous, used all over the world. And what it does is it measures the development of what are called high net worth individuals. Those are individuals around the world, the whole planet, who have above a certain number of millions of dollars worth of income and or assets. They very proudly released their report recently. They very proudly show that in 2009, a disaster year for the world economy, the number of these individuals rose and their average wealth rose 17%. So for people at the top, the economic crisis was no crisis at all. That's one measure. The second measure is the stock market had a quote-unquote recovery over most of the last year. It's no longer happening, but it did for a while, that recouped about a half, more or less, of the losses. So for people who had enough stocks, which is a very minority of Americans, they got at least some of their wealth that they lost back. So we're talking about an austerity imposed on a mass of people, while those closest to the authorities and decision makers who brought us this crisis are the ones who have relatively done real well. One last measure. Try to think of this if you can stand it. The banks of the United States and the world are among the most important creditors to governments. They are the buyers of government debt. So now follow the bouncing ball. The bankers produce a crisis. The government bails them out. The government borrows from them to bail them out. And now the government is imposing an austerity on everybody else to make sure they pay back the banks who have lent them the money that the banks were bailed out with. If you understand that, you understand what it means to say that modern capitalism is a system designed for the benefits of a very few people and is even well enough organized that during a crisis, that situation doesn't change.
So, doesn't sound great. What do we do
practically,
next?
Practically.
What happens?
Well, let's go back. You've already told Michael's question before was the right one. One option is to say, wait a minute. Why are we paying off these debts? Let's rethink about it. For example, maybe it was a major mistake of the United States government faced with a crisis to solve it by borrowing the money to do so. Maybe that was the point at which to go after those who haven't paid taxes in the past, those with the greatest ability to pay. That would allow the government to raise huge amounts of money to solve a problem, but raise it from the people most close to those responsible for it and not impose it either then or now on the mass of people. It's the basic question, who's going to pay for the mess that was made? And we all do know, after all, that investment bankers and AIG Insurance Corporation and executives at GM are the ones who made the decisions that got us into that mess. And it's an interesting question why it's the mass of people's subway rides and school lunches for their kids are the things to be hurt in order to fix this problem, even while those closest to the cause of the problem are faring very nicely. Thank you.
The crisis happens. The banks need to be given a huge amount of money to get out of their problems, their bad assets brought up. The way that happened is the government borrowed that money by issuing bonds all over the world or wherever in the United States. Institutions bought those bonds.
Right.
And now those institutions are saying, we want our bonds paid off or rolled over, but you have to have the money to pay it.
And you look to be so badly in debt. And the bankers are not stupid. They know there's popular opposition, and they know it's serious. Let's remind, it's not just Greece that has general strikes. I was in France last week. I went to a meeting of all the six national trade union federations. There are six of them in France because they don't agree on very many things. But they were agreeing on this. They were all sitting around the table organizing the general strike that will close everything in France on the 7th of September, which is an act against the Sarkozy government on the question of austerity. And the Railway Workers Union was announcing at the moment that I was at the meeting how everything is arranged, they've taken care of it. The only trains that will move in France on the 7th of September are the trains taking demonstrators from the unions to the various cities where for Americans to try to understand. They're further along, they've been organized in a different way for a long time, they're different cultures from ours. But the struggle, the banks see this. They see the movement that may make them not get paid back, or maybe not get paid back 100%, a renegotiation like the government is doing with mortgage folks who can't pay their mortgages. You give them a lower rate. You forgive a portion of what they owe. All of that is in the mix for what may be done now, and it isn't an economic question, and it isn't a technical question. This is a political question. Will the pressure rise on the Republicans, Democrats, whoever's in office, to renegotiate this debt with those who've lent the money and say, look, now it's your turn to take it on the chin if we're going to work all this out? It's the old problem of creditor-debtor, but it does raise all these political questions, and in the end, that will make the difference.
Let me ask a question about the G20 that just happened, where Obama went and all the countries are talking about austerity, and Obama is saying something like, don't put that much austerity, don't do that much austerity.
It's just a question of timing. In Europe, because they didn't have the kind of crunch in their society that we did. For example, the increase in unemployment in this country, much larger than what happened in Europe, a much more dramatic impact here on the United States. We don't as a nation like to admit it, and our pundits don't say it, but that is the case. So for the Europeans, they, having now managed the crisis in their own minds, I'm not sure they're right, but that's what they think, they're concerned to solve now this debt problem, so they're imposing austerities, or trying to. Be aware that what you read in the newspaper are statements by the government about austerity they're planning. They haven't done it yet, in most cases, even in Greece. And it's not clear that they'll be able to politically. The new government in Britain, for example, Mr. Cameron, he is making all kinds of statements. But even inside his own coalition of the two parties that run England now, there are an increasing number of what are called backbenchers, the people in Parliament, who don't want what he's doing because they won't get reelected. It'll be a landslide for the Labour Party. As, by the way, there was in the last national election in France, the Sarkozy government, which talks about austerity, hasn't done it yet, lost in 21 out of the 22 departments, that's what they call their states there, in 21 out of the 22 elections, Sarkozy lost. And a coalition of socialists and communists and Greens won. So the political landscape in France is moving very strongly against austerity. So there's a lot of recognition that this kind of crisis is just beginning to hit.
But the Obama issue on that.
I'm sorry, yeah. Yes, the Obama issue. Obama has two concerns. He hasn't yet gotten to the point where he wants people to think about austerity. And the reason is that works for the Republicans. The Republicans are yelling all the time, gee, the deficit's getting larger. We're going to have to pay that for generations. The usual Republic. He doesn't want to help them. And austerity is very close to saying we oughtn't to have a deficit. We ought to be taking it down. We ought to be paying off our creditors. So he doesn't like that. It does the work of his enemies, number one. Number two, Obama has said that one of the ways out of this crisis for the United States is by an explosion of American exports. That's his hope. And one of the reasons he says that is because there's nothing else he can point to that could get us out of this mess. But in order for exports to happen, the rest of the world has to be in a position to buy. And if our major trading partner, Europe, is going through a big austerity, that means people with higher taxes and lower government spending are not going to be in a position to buy American exports. So it's damaging to America in its hopes of getting out of this crisis, that the European – and so he doesn't want them to do that. He wants them to stimulate their economy to make more exports for the United States. So it's an anger of his because he doesn't want to get to this austerity yet. Oh, it's already coming, but he doesn't want to get to it yet. He still has to try to get us out of what hurts us more than the Europeans, which is this enormous problem of unemployment.
Now, Rick, you have a couple of things I want to have you mention. One, you have a book that's relatively recent and your website where we can read more about this.
Yes, I do ask people to go to my website. Everything on there is utterly freely accessible to anybody. All of this is written up. There are articles there about Greece. There are videos and audio tapes and interviews being added all the time. The website address is www.rdwolf.com. So it's www.rdwolf.com. I do invite your listeners to go there because they can follow up anything I've just said and our whole discussion in all kinds of ways there and ways that will be added to literally every day. I'm putting something up there. And I would urge people to do that. The book, which is a compilation of writings, it's all short pieces that are easily understandable, written for a general audience, has the name Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown, and What to Do About It. That's available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and any of the usual ways, or through my website. You can also order it that way.
Rick, is there any country that you would cite as a model of doing things the right way, i.e. going to the corporations, those other organizations, rather than the people?
Actually, the best example I would give you is not a foreign country, but an American state. One state in the United States did something different from all the other 49. And it's worth telling this story because so few Americans know about it. In the summer of 2009, the legislature of the little state of Oregon on the West Coast did something extraordinary. The Democratic Party is the power party there. It has the governorship and it controls both houses of the state legislature. A bill went through that said the following remarkable thing. We face a crisis like every other state. with all these people unemployed and everyone losing their home, the revenues that the state collects are way down, and that means we can't do the usual things. And if we do like our sister state to the south, California, it means raising taxes or cutting government services and employment, and we're not going to do it. We are not going to do it. So how are we going to deal with a $700 million gap over a two-year period? That was the number they dealt with. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to raise taxes on business, and we're going to raise taxes on wealthy people. That's how we're going to solve the problem. And to the amazement of everybody, both houses of the legislature passed the bill. They sent it to the governor, and to the amazement of everyone, the governor signed it. This is now in the late summer of 2009. At that point, because of the laws of the western states, which allow referendums relatively easily, unlike the east, the Republican Party and the business community were up in arms. This is terrible. This will be the end of civilization and the state of Oregon and all the rest of it. But they found it quite easy to force a referendum. So they gathered signatures. They went through the procedure. They qualified. And I believe it was the end of January or early February of this year, 2010, a referendum was held. 1.2 million citizens of Oregon went to the polls and upheld the law. And so in Oregon, unlike other states, there will be no cutbacks and there will be no taxes on 9/10 of the population. People earning over $250,000 a year saw a significant jump in their income tax rate, and people earning over $500,000, an even bigger one. And businesses were suddenly required to pay. There was a minimum tax was raised. You'll love the minimum tax. The last time a minimum tax was imposed in Oregon was in the last Great Depression, 1931, at the lordly sum of $10 a year. So if you are a corporation, no matter what else you do, a minimum tax of $10 a year. They raised that to $150 a year, which in percentage terms is quite a large sum. But, you know, it's a different mindset. And when the struggle came, when the people of Oregon had to vote, a coalition of community groups, trade unions, and the Democratic Party mobilized as much as they could, the business community Republicans, and it was a clear defeat for the business community Republican, clear win. So the notion that you can do nothing and there's no alternative is disproved, and you don't have to go outside the United States. We have an example here.
Well, terrific. Rick, thank you for being with us.
Thanks,
it's one of the
Rick.
Clearest explanations, the clearest,
yes.
That I've ever had of where we are today.
Okay. Well,
fabulous, completely fabulous. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.